Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. So welcome to the next episode of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Sharon Hartman, and I'm currently in Tallahassee. And the cool thing is that, they have a community here that I've been supporting them for maybe the last 4 or 5 years, something like that. And there's a strong community of Ashtanga people. You know, they don't have a teacher. They don't have someone that they check in with regularly. And so I always feel like, you know, these weekends are always awesome because everyone kind of gets what they need or some sort of refreshers. So I thought it was a perfect opportunity to sit down with Sharon and kind of, you know, talk to her about like her stories with regard to, you know, the Ashtanga method and like how, you know, the sobriety and all of these things kind of came to be. And so I appreciate you being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so the first thing that I'll ask is just give us a little bit of background. Are you from Tallahassee? Or?
No, I'm from New Jersey originally.
Okay.
So that's where I get some of my sass.
The New Jersey sass.
Yeah.
All right. And so tell us a little bit about like your, like the pre-story. Like, you know, did you go to college? How did you do in high school? Like, you know, tell us about those formative years around that time.
I was adopted into a family, and I always, like, my brother was also adopted, but he has some developmental problems. So I, even though I was the younger sister, I always sort of had to be the grown up.
Yeah.
And there was some violence in my household. Really, I wasn't really around alcoholism or addiction at all. But there was definitely some unsettling aspects to my childhood.
Okay.
Because my brother struggled with everything. I mean, this poor kid would like throw up on his way to get on the school bus, you know, like there was just constant
anxiety.
Yeah. Well, it was just, I mean, he had so much trouble in school. He couldn't really regulate emotions. Like, you know, I suspect Asperger's,
yeah.
But that wasn't really like a diagnosis that was used very much back then. Like,
yeah.
This is like mid-90s.
Yeah.
So I made, I made sure that I was always perfect. You know,
yeah.
I got really good grades. And I always say like my first drug of choice was reading. Because I would just escape into worlds of books and, you know.
To escape the reality of, like, what your situation was?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so do you feel like you had a rough childhood?
I don't think it was rough. I think, for the most part, I think I was just sort of forgotten. Because I was, like, normal. You know? I wasn't seen at all.
And so do you and your brother have the same parent?
No.
The same mother? Okay.
Yeah.
So you come from different mothers and different fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Yeah.
And so both of you guys were adopted at the same time?
He's 4 years older than me.
Okay.
So I was adopted at like 7 weeks.
Okay.
I think he was a little bit older.
Okay.
So, but they had him first and then adopted me second.
Got
so,
it.
Yeah.
And was it a happy home?
I don't think I can honestly say that. I think everybody was just sort of like in their own version of escapism, you know?
And do you feel like, you got what you needed out of your childhood?
No, definitely not.
Because you had to escape so much?
Yeah. Well, okay. So this is, my mom has this like crazy doll collection in her house. And when I was a little baby, I looked like a porcelain doll.
Okay.
And so I was like put in pageants and I was like, you know, my hair would get curled and teased and makeup and all this stuff. And like, I was basically treated like her doll.
Okay.
So like I was almost her escape in a way. My dad was just like working 60, 70 hours a week. I didn't see him very much. And my brother did his like video games and weird statistics, you know, like very Asperger-y stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's like, love was shown through buying gifts. It wasn't really through, oh, how's your day at school? What's your, you know, little friend's name and blah, 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 that kind of stuff. There was no real interest. I was like a tool to, you know, get on like with my mom's business of being comforted and satisfied in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the best that she knew how to do. It's not her fault.
No.
She missed something along the way as well.
And so looking back, I mean, do you have regret with, you know, some of, you know, like your childhood?
No. You know, that's sort of one of the gifts that working a program of recovery has given me is that I have never had to go through any pain in vain, right? Like I have always been able to use it in some way. Like my higher power has put some woman into my life that's asking for help. And I'm like, I know how to use this pain that I went through 20, 30 years ago. You know, that I've worked through the steps and even worked through on my yoga mat, you know, like that stuff with my mom definitely came up, like performance stuff, right? When I was new to this practice.
Right.
But yeah, I've always been able to use any of the pain that I've gone through.
So it wasn't for nothing.
No. And that's like the gift of recovery.
Yeah, for sure. And so tell us a little bit about the transition because you mentioned like you're sober.
Yeah.
And, like some of the lessons, but tell us like, you know, basically the, you know, what happened? Like, why did you turn to drugs?
Right. So how I went from a porcelain doll to like a hot mess.
I mean, it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
The reason why is because like, you know, you're not a porcelain doll, you know, like you're a real person, you have feelings. Like,
yeah.
You know, and so, you know, if you're being treated like that, of course, there's going to be some sort of escapism into something else.
Yeah.
And so how did you make the transition into drinking and using? Like, what was your first experience with like with alcohol?
I think honestly, it was, it transitioned really easily because I went from being that doll to like being like the good partier, the one that like, you know, showed up and was the life of the party at my friend's house growing up in high school. And I always felt like, you know, I always had really cool cars. I always like had, I was one of the first people in my, if really the only person in my high school that was doing like hard drugs. Cause I was like going to Philadelphia and going to dance clubs and, you know, meeting all the right people and like all of that status stuff was really important to me. And yeah, so that's how that went. Okay. It was an obvious
segue. What about
16, 17?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, when I started drinking at like 11, 12, you know, like with my middle school friends at their house on the weekends. But it really got off to the races and hard drugs got involved when I was 17.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's when you started going to clubs and stuff like
that. Yes. Yeah.
And so, what was your worst day drinking and using? Tell us what that looked like.
Yikes. There's definitely a couple, but I mean, okay, I'll give you the
just like describe what it felt like and like where you were at and like what it looked like.
Okay. I mean, this is the one that like I tell the women I work with when I'm going to make them comfortable. Right. Okay. So, this was when I was trying to get my life together. I was in a long-term treatment center and every 3 months I would run away because it would just get too intense. Like I was too overwhelmed with like actual life on life's terms. And this time I had ran away. It was my 21st birthday. And I was like, I'm not going to drink. I just want to go home to New Jersey and see my family for my birthday. And my therapists were literally like, all right, our hats are off to you. Like, go ahead. They knew what I was going to do, but they also knew they weren't reaching me, you know? So they let me go home. And I sat at the bar at midnight and I was like, I'm going to get one shot and that's it. Right. And then, as the words are coming out of my mouth, I would like one shot. It came out as I'll have a double shot. And within an hour, I'm like doing cocaine in the bathroom with the bartender. I got some guy in the parking lot selling me pills. Like I lost a shoe. And then I went on a run from like Jersey to Georgia. And, I went back to treatment for a little while in between. And then I ran to Georgia where I had a friend from the clubs in Philly. And, I that was the time I almost got AIDS because I met some guy who was like had cancer, old guy who had like the best OxyContin prescription ever. He had like 120 of that, the 80s, right? Wow. That's a big deal. Like, and it's I was like, money. Yeah, right. And he was giving them to me for free. So I'm like, you're my new best friend, you know, and we like go to his hotel room. And of course I start nodding out. And I guess, you know, like he tried to have his way with me and he called me at treatment. And, you know, cause at some point in my like high stupor, I was like, here's the number to my apartment at treatment. Let's be friends, you know? And he was like, yeah, you need to get tested because, you know, I'm HIV positive. And, yeah. And I was 21 years old, you know? I remember just like dropping the phone and being like, this is real shit. Like, this is real consequences that are coming my way.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't fun and games anymore. This is where I'm headed. It went really bad, really quick for me. Like, I was already in long-term treatment by the time I was 21. And we just said like 17 is when I started drugs. So yeah, I just off to the races real quick.
Wow.
So
yeah, I can see where that would like totally put you in a place of send you right in into your head.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
That was probably the worst day.
And so did you get sober after that point?
A little bit longer. Yeah. There were a couple more like attempts and a couple more failures. And then, I had applied to go back to college, when I was in treatment and I was accepted to this like little private school in St. Augustine, Florida. And, I had originally gone to Temple University in Philadelphia, really great party school. but I was also like accepted for my vocal music talent. I wanted to be a teacher, wanted to teach music. I only lasted about half a semester there. So when I told my father I wanted to go back to school, he was like, well, if I'm paying for it, you're going where I tell you to go.
And where did he tell you to go?
He told me to go to Flagler College in St. Augustine because it was like one of the best, deals for the education at the time. And we had been vacationing in St. Augustine since I was little. So I was familiar. But I moved to college with 2 weeks sober.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was terrified, terrified.
How did you do that?
I don't know. Yeah.
Have you been sober since that point?
Yeah. Yeah. I just went to meetings, you know, and I latched on to people and there was only three people in the room, that were under the age of 50. And, one of them is still sober today and it was a guy. And I had a big crush on him and I asked him to go out with me and he said no. And then I hated him for like the next 10 years. Oh yeah. I was not, I didn't get well really quickly. I'm not one of those.
Yeah.
I hung on to all of my character defects that still worked. Like, you know, my first couple of years sober. Yeah. I put down the drugs and the alcohol, but I picked up my eating disorder, which I had had when I was a teenager, just wasn't my primary mode of escape. But now I had lost like my dear friends, drugs and alcohol. And I'm like, well, you know, I got to make do with what's not going to kill me right away.
Right.
And then that got really bad to the point where the guy that I was dating was like, you're no longer like a human being. You're just sort of a shell of a person. I don't feel.
So why do you think that you turn to those things in order to cope with life?
Why
drugs and alcohol? Why food disorder, eating disorders? Why do you kind of get steered in that direction?
Well, because I didn't trust in anything greater than myself, you know, like it was the Sharon show, you know, and if I couldn't handle it, then I needed to run. I needed to cut and run.
And they were always run the, like those, you know, drugs and alcohol and eating disorder, that those are all running in your mind.
Running or avoiding, like stick my head in the sand, kind of.
I mean, what were you running from or avoiding?
Like just life. Yeah. Just normal.
Not your past. You don't feel like you're.
I definitely that set me up, you know, but I think the bigger problem is in the way that I see the world currently, you know, like the way that left to my own devices, I can still see the world today, here and now, is dysfunctional and delusional. You know, if I don't check in with a power greater than myself and I start running the show, it's not pretty. Like I have these markers that happen. Like if I'm spiritually off the beam, I get overwhelmed, right? That's the first one that happens. I start telling little white lies. I get very indecisive, right? These are like the things that happen for me. And those, if I think back on like when I would feel the urge to act out in the eating disorder or to drink or whatever, the first thing that always happened was I'm overwhelmed. Well, yeah, because I'm like trying to do life. Like human beings are social animals. We're not supposed to manage everything on our own. Mm-hmm. We're just not wired that way. But I was never given the resources growing up so that I could ask for help or that people would be interested in helping me or getting to know, being seen in that way. So I'm like, all right, I'm in this alone. I got this. I can always get help financially, right? I was given that message. And that's a blessing. I'm incredibly fortunate to have that. I don't, I don't negate that at all. But when it comes to like emotional support, I never had it. So I just assumed that this thing we call life is done alone. And then, I come into the 12-step rooms and they're like, yeah, no, the first word of the first step is we, And it took me a long time to really start to understand that. I was like, all right, I gotcha. I'll come to these meetings or whatever, but like, I'm still gonna do my own thing. And, I would talk about surrender. I would, I knew how to say things well. But if you looked at my actions, like the women that I work with, I'm like words and actions, right? Like if you're smart, if you're relatively intelligent, you'll know what to say. Yeah. But if your actions aren't matching, then like you're full of shit. Yeah. And it's easy to see.
It is easy to see.
When I first met you, I was full of shit in a lot of ways.
Correct.
Yeah. And I still am to this day, but not in the same ways.
Well, I told you that yesterday. It's like, you're just walking defect of character.
Yeah.
It's hard to be around you.
Yeah.
I understood what you were going through, so I had like some empathy around it. But, I think when you asked about whether or not like Jess was sponsoring and stuff like that, my wife, it was just like, oh yeah, you definitely need to do that because she's real like strong in her big book stuff and all of that. And so I thought it would be helpful for you. But I remember like having that conversation around that stuff and you were like, I feel like I need to dive a little bit deeper. And it's like, yes, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when I had met you, I hadn't had a sponsor in about a year.
Okay.
Right. And I can't really like do this for that long on my own.
Yeah. It's hard. Mm-hmm. Super hard.
Because I get really like cocky, and I forget that there's so much that I don't know.
Yeah. I've been talking a lot about denial.
Yeah.
It just creeps right in and all of a sudden it just kind of takes over everything.
Totally.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about like your spiritual program and tell me like, what sobriety looks like for you today.
Well, I've been doing this for a little while, 12 years, and I go to at least 2 to 3 meetings a week, and I sponsor a lot of women, and I'm a big advocate for, like, sober fam, so, like, the girls that I work with, they talk to each other, and they talk to me, and, I think that that's important to me because I didn't have that growing up. I'm literally just making this connection as we're talking right now, and that's really cool. But I get up every morning and I pray, and I read the book, and I read lots of other spiritual literature. And then what happens for me is typically I'll pick up the book again, and it reads differently.
Yeah,
it's not that the book has changed. I've just grown.
So have you worked all the steps?
Oh, yeah.
How many times?
This is my fourth time.
Fourth time?
Yeah. So I did it the first time through, and then I did it around the eating disorder, and then I did it around when I got really ill, and then this time. So it's every, like, two, three years.
Got it.
Yeah.
And what does it mean to work the, work the steps? What does that mean?
Well, it's, admitting that you're powerless. Okay, so in the tiniest nutshell, trust God, clean house, help others, right? So we have to admit that we're powerless over something And the first step is broken up into two pieces. So you have the powerless element, and then there's a hyphen, and then it's unmanageability. And there's a reason that's set up that way, because typically a lot of us come in and we're like, yeah, I'm powerless over alcohol, but my life's all right. You know, or they're the opposite. That was me. I knew my life was unmanageable, but I didn't really want to admit that it was drugs and alcohol, which is, you know, why it was pretty quick that I picked up other things, other behaviors, coping mechanisms, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. So
tell me what, you know, it looks like to sponsor someone. Like, you know, you said you sponsor a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Like, tell me about that.
That's like my favorite thing to do.
Helping other people?
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Because, well, one, selfishly, it gets me out of me, you know, like at my very core, if I were to lose everything, you know, like somehow didn't have a house or money to eat or anything, like I have a default purpose of being useful to my fellows. And that's cool because I was just sort of a drifter, just, you know, reaching for feelings, you know, that I deemed worthy. I was reaching for experiences of numbness, pretty much. And so that the fact that I can be useful to my fellows is, it's a trip.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
Yeah. And the cool thing is it benefits me, because if I'm, you know, being useful to someone else, then I'm not thinking about these like obsessive stories that I can tell myself about myself, or about you, or about my circumstances and how unfair they are, and all of that stuff that happens when I think about, when I'm left alone for long enough, it's inevitable that I'm gonna get into some kind of delusion. I'm thankful that today it doesn't take long for me to realize, like, you know, either someone calls me or I have to go meet someone, or, you know, sometimes my mind will humble itself where I'm just like, whoa, you went to crazy town there, you know? And, but that's like, that doesn't happen. I can't rely on that. Right. Yeah. 'Cause that's what I did for so many years. But yeah, sponsoring people, taking them through the steps, watching them realize that their problem centers in their mind and that they're really, really selfish. You know, because I didn't think I was selfish. I didn't think I was angry when I first came in. I know.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. And watching them start to come to terms with the things that they did and make restitution for that. And then, like, I love really diving into 6 and 7 because of why, because I sort of ignored them for quite a few years.
I mean, they're easy to ignore. They're super small.
Well, and I was talking to somebody about this the other day. I honestly think that the founders did that on purpose, because if you had told me that I had to, that you had to like strip me of all of my defects or all of my, you know, bad behaviors, so to speak, in the very beginning, I don't know that I would have stuck around. That's just me. Yeah. I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I agree with that. So it sounds like you'd be a pretty tough sponsor.
I am.
Wow.
Yeah. I have a reputation of being like kind of a hard ass, and you know, I tell them, like, if you're not mad at me at some point, then I'm not doing my job right. You know, like, I'm not here to like tell you like everything's going to be fine and like, oh, you ran out of cat food, but you didn't drink. Good job. You know, like that's not what this is about. Like,
yeah. What's it about, though?
It's going to get uncomfortable. I'm going to call you on your shit, you know, and this is like why I enjoy having people like you and Jess in my life, because I don't like it in the moment, you know, nobody does, but give me a couple days, you know, sometimes a couple hours, a couple minutes, even in the middle of a practice, you know, and it's just like, all right, he's right.
Yeah.
She's right. You know, 'cause I'm not, I'm just not.
I mean, you know, several years ago when I first met you, I felt like I had to call you out more.
I'm sure you did.
I had to call you out way more.
Yeah.
Yeah, but nowadays, like, I don't feel like I have to call you out. Like, you're doing the work necessary, which is pretty cool. But, I mean, I'm interested in, like, why yoga took part in your path. Like,
yeah.
Like, how did, where's the intersection between yoga and sobriety? Like, how did that happen?
Well, what happened is I tried to be my own higher power for, you know, quite a few years. And then, you know, as the big book says, or no, I think it's the 12 and 12, like, it talks about, like, eventually life hands us some big lump, right, that we can't manage to swallow, let alone digest. I also don't know this stuff by heart. I literally heard this in a meeting last night because, like, I always wonder that. Like, do people know this by heart? No. I know some of it by heart.
Yeah.
Me too. But, yeah, so I got really, really sick out of nowhere and couldn't really figure out what was wrong. I went from a very physically healthy, not mentally or emotionally or spiritually healthy, like 25-year-old, to sleeping like 20 hours a day. I would drive in my hometown and I would get lost. Like I couldn't, like neurologically, I couldn't really form complete sentences. It just went rapidly.
What was going on?
I had Lyme disease. And it took them 3 years to diagnose. So the thing with Lyme disease is just like alcoholism. It's progressive, right? If you don't treat it, it gets worse and worse and worse. And there's a whole story behind that as to why it's difficult to diagnose Lyme. It took about 3 years. And because of my history as a drug addict, when I went to doctors, they're, you know, oh, you're med seeking, you know. They sent me for psychiatric evaluations, that kind of stuff. And I started to sort of believe them, you know, like maybe I am making this up. I don't know. Because, you know, I had been taught to question myself, but
mind is tricky. So I totally understand that for sure. But, you know, getting to the root that it, all of a sudden it's like Lyme disease. It's a little disheartening that everyone thought it was a neurological.
Or psychosomatic or whatever. When I finally got diagnosed, I started to get, that 3 year period was probably the driest I've ever been. And cause I kept trying to will myself into health. Right. And that doesn't work.
No, it's impossible.
I just kept trying to be normal and I would hit brick walls like on the regular. And I started working with a new sponsor then. And, she was like the most Christian person I'd ever met, and I have my own issues with Christianity, and I was like, okay, this is what I need, right? Like something you said today and you say often, like what we resist is what we need to dive into. So I started working with her and I realized, so this was like year five, right? And in the program there's like a little like saying that when you hit 5 years that's when your head pops out of your butt. And it kind of happened for me because I've started consistently praying. For the first time ever, I was talking to God on a daily basis.
Wow.
Yeah, right? It took me that long. I'm slow to the get up, but man, like I'll always come through. So when I started praying, I started meditating, right? And I think I was waiting to figure it out. When I understand God, that's when I'll start praying. When I figure this out and I'm more comfortable with it. But that's totally backwards. Like we gain trust through action. I got to do it. Yeah. And then the faith and the trust and the understanding comes. So I started this like higher power stuff for realsies. And then I was finally diagnosed. Right. And so I was kind of in a place where I was like, all right, now I got to get my body back to health. And a friend of mine in the program like had just done her teacher training and she was teaching and she's like, I'm teaching karma classes. And like totally cliche, I read Eat, Pray, Love at the time. And I was like, all right, I'll give this a shot.
How long ago was that?
That was 2012. Yeah. And I liked it immediately. Like immediately I knew this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yoga?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it felt spiritual to you? Or connected?
I felt like I was regaining my body. Like, because I...
After being unhealthy, though?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, not only from years of drug addiction and eating disorder, and then, you know, once I'd really sort of fixed all of that externally, but I hadn't really done the spiritual work, right? I just sort of arranged the circumstances so that I had figured out how to somewhat white knuckle through that. Like I had the group of drunks as my higher power, right? Like I used the meetings, I used my sponsor, but past that, I didn't really use anything.
Yeah.
And so inevitably my life gave me something that the group of drunks wasn't going to be able to manage for me. Just wasn't. And so then getting through that, I lost my body again, right? Like now I'm sick and I'm sleeping 20 hours a day and all my joints ache and I'm having weird pains and numbness and And I got on my yoga mat and I'm like, I can feel my body again. Like I started to feel proud of my body again. Yeah. So, and it wasn't.
Were you practicing Ashtanga?
It was like a Ashtanga Vinyasa hybrid fitness type thing.
Yeah.
But they taught Ashtanga at that studio and I started taking primary series classes there. And I was like, there's something to this. I like the tempo of it. I like, you know, how I'm doing the same thing every day. I didn't really understand why I liked it, but it fit with me.
Well, why do you like it? I mean, why looking now do you like it?
Well, so today, pretty much the beginning at the top of every class that I teach, I talk about that whole, like, okay, so this is an experiment, right? We have the control group that is the set of postures that we show up every day and we do. The variable is me, is you, how well you're taking care of yourself, how much I'm lying to myself, you know? How are the relationships in my life and how are they affecting me? What's the ripple effect, you know, of my actions and how it's affecting my practice? That's why I show up. That's why Ashtanga works for me.
Because it gives you that reflective experience to kind of dive inside and see what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And then not only that, but there's this visceral, like, when I overcome something on the mat, that it's the same stories that I'm telling myself, you know, why I can't go back to school or I can't make friends with, like, those people or whatever. Like, whatever the story is that day. And I overcome the same stories with regard to a pose. Oh, I can't do that because of X, Y, and Z. And then it happens, you know, and it just takes consistent effort from me and me getting out of the way and, you know, listening when someone tells me to do something,
yeah.
Which is pretty much the way the steps work and the program.
Totally.
So,
I mean, do you think that you could continue to be sober if you didn't have yoga today? Or do you think it's been become like such a big part of your sobriety that you can't really extract one from another?
So, I mean, I did that for about a year when I had started doing Ashtanga. I was very much like asana grabbing. If you had asked me then, I don't know that I would have said that. But I was definitely like all or nothing. I'm going to will myself through this. Right. Cause that was a like strategy that even though it hadn't worked for me, I was comfortable and familiar with.
Right.
I had willed myself through lots of stuff. Not always gracefully, but, and then I hit dropping back and standing up. And I was not going to be able to will myself through that. There was no amount of strength or like chutzpah or, you know, whatever that was going to get me through that. I had to break
open. Why did you struggle with that so much?
I don't know. I'm sure it's based on the way I grew up and all of that stuff.
You're sure about that?
I don't know. I'm not sure about anything, right? Like, I don't know.
And so why were you able to drop back and stand up?
Well, I gave up for about a year. I just...
And you stomped your feet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And you got angry.
Yeah. And I got angry at other people and I made it their fault.
Yeah, I think you got angry at me for a second.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know.
So yeah, I did, you know, like after, it's sort of like when you first come into AA and they say like, you'll never be able to drink again, right? Like with a belly full of booze and a head full of AA, it'll just ruin it.
Right.
And like once you sort of tie Ashtanga in with recovery, it's hard to do one without the other.
Yeah.
And so when I did, a lot of like we were talking about last night with like the yamas and the niyamas. So a lot of my niyama practices of like how I took care of myself started to fall away. You know, like I wasn't really taking care of myself sleep wise or food wise and all the stuff that like, you know, it's extra important for someone who's dealing with autoimmune chronic illness stuff.
Of course, yeah.
You know, let alone just anyone in the world. And then an Ashtanga practitioner. Because we do hard stuff.
We do hard things.
Yeah.
And so tell me, like, are you able to, you know, practice on a daily basis and it helps maintain, like, the, you know, Lyme disease and stuff? Or
yeah, it definitely helps with my joints. And I think it just makes me a lot more mindful in my choices.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's a little easier to put the, like, bad habits away.
Is that like the primary reason why you practice? Because of the health of the body?
No.
So tell me why you practice.
So my why is that it makes me a more useful person to my God and my fellows, you know, and my higher power continues to sort of show me the lies that I tell myself in this practice as I'm breathing and moving through. And it's so experiential. Like, someone who hasn't actually experienced this would not understand. Like, I've explained this to women I work with that start coming to yoga, and they're like, yeah, this, she's totally out there, you know? And then they stick around long enough and they're like, they get it.
Yeah.
It's like, you have to move through it to understand.
Yeah. It's experiential for sure. I remember I did a lead one time, and a guy came up to me, and he's like, maybe you could talk about less yoga and more AA. And
I was I get it. Oh. I get it.
I was like, that's a small little clap for you, buddy. Like, it's like, you don't get it at all.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that yoga was holding hands and singing Kumbaya, right? Like, this was not our style of yoga at all. So my why of yoga is like, it helps me be a more mindful, aware, observant person who's like willing to help others rather than just thinking about herself.
Yeah. Does it make you happy?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what do you learn at the most challenging times of your practice? Like, what are the things that you learn?
That I can experience a whole range of emotions, and that, like, you know, in its most purest form, like, feelings are not facts. Like, I can still breathe. I can stay still. I can sit with it and not have to immediately put my head in the sand. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't like to do that stuff still, right? Like, looking at somebody else's practice, or, oh my God, right now I have to pee, or, you know, all those ways that I can still stick my head in the sand. And that also is okay, right? Because that's part of the process. Now, you know, if I'm doing it all day, every day, I might as well not show up. But when it happens sometimes, I don't necessarily have to use that to beat myself up either. Yeah. Because here's the thing about that. Like, there's this awareness of something I don't like, but then there's acceptance. And then on the other side of acceptance is action. So if I get stuck in that place of beating myself up and not accepting where I am today, I'm never actually going to change it. I'm never going to get there, because I'm going to be immobilized in shame. And yeah, so it's like, even when I don't do all of the things that I know I could or should do, that's what it is today. And that's the consistency thing, like showing up 5-6 days a week. It's okay if I don't give 110% every day, because I'm coming back tomorrow, you know?
Right. What else do you get out of the yoga? What else do you get out of the yoga practice? Like, I mean, is there even a deeper aspect to it than what you just described there?
Well, I mean, I think that it makes me surrender my ideas. There is a connection to the divine of just like feeling my own body.
And you feel like your asanas are kind of your prayers, or you feel like the asana like connection some way to your higher power?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wouldn't say the asanas are my prayers. I would say it's more on the meditation side. Cause I do, like, every day I get on the mat, I say some version of the third step or the seventh step prayer, typically the third step before I start. And then I chant the mantra and, I would say it's more on the meditation side because of the observances that I'm sort of given in those moments.
Yeah.
But there's an aspect of prayer to it. Like, you know, my hands are coming to my heart, and, you know, I'm sun salutations. It's, I mean, if we look at the history of it, they really are. What is it? Prostration, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Well, I mean, it's very interesting to hear your take, because, you know, like, you have almost as much time as me in sobriety, and, like, you know, like, I know that you're kind of a tough sponsee or whatever, and I'm kind of a tough teacher, or at least some people would say I'm a tough teacher. And so it's interesting to kind of hear, like, how the background, I mean, you know, the intersection between, like, AA and the Yoga Sutras and, you know, like, our 12 steps and the 8 limbs and all of this stuff, like, being put together, is they're almost like sister sciences.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's something pretty powerful, I think, that, you know, I don't think that it necessarily has to be something that you are struggling with an addiction of some sort, that you use these two things. I mean, AA or 12 steps, is really like a really good way to set up a life, or a framework for life. And so then all of a sudden you add yoga and it opens up your heart and opens up your mind and all that stuff. And they working together, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And I mean, there's the issue in our tissue kind of thing. Like, yeah. I think I had gotten to a point in the rooms, you know, of what I was willing to do and talk about. Like, I'd talked about it all, but I wasn't quite fully willing to change my behavior, you know, and give it all to God, right? And then I come in here and I do some, like, backbending, right? I jump around on a sticky mat for a while.
Right.
And then I'm, like, crying, and all of a sudden I'm willing, right? I'm, like, going to more meetings,
right.
And I'm picking up the phone, and I'm praying more, and I'm reading more spiritual literature. And I think that, like, I don't begin to understand why or how that works, and I'm not gonna, because it's beyond my control.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, like, I think it broke open some things in my physical body that have been hanging out there for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, I've had those reactions on the mat where all of a sudden I'm like gasping for air in your bathroom in Ohio, like at AYC, like having flashbacks of like assault, you know? And that's like, it needs to come out. Like, you know, there's that whole thing in AA, well, like 12 step programs, where they say like our secrets keep us sick. You know, but like, what if I'm not even aware of my secrets yet? You know, there's like stuff shoved so far down there that even if I were to talk about it, even if I were to pay a therapist, you know, $100 an hour for the next 5 years, I wouldn't get to.
Right.
That this yoga somehow accesses rapidly.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing too.
Yeah.
So, well, thanks for being on the show. Thanks for sharing your heart. And
thanks for sharing, Sharon.
Yeah. And thanks for, kind of giving your takes on the yoga. I appreciate all of your thoughts, and I appreciate you being a student and all your dedication. It means a lot to me and a lot to a lot of other people. And so keep doing the work, Sharon.
Thanks for putting up with me.
All right. Thanks for being on.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.